Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Again, everybody, here we are at the Wild Wild Podcast, still in the thick of the jungle, and my name is Adrian, and I am joined by my friend and co-host from across several time zones. It's Rod Barnett.
Hello, Mr. Smith.
Yeah, hello, and yes, we did manage to get our time zone change differences wrong this time, but hey, we're here now and we're recording and everything's good. We get to go to Borneo, which is exciting this time.
This is true. At least they're telling us we're going there.
Yeah. Who knows where we really are. We're still in a Jungle Girl season, and quite an interesting film hopefully to talk about today. Certainly, based on what I can find online, it feels like maybe about 12 people have seen this film in the last 50 years.
Wow.
So we're shedding some light.
And I've seen it twice. That's dangerous. So.
Yeah, so we're shedding light on a film that really is very ignored, it would appear. But anyway, before we get into that, I don't have any sort of major news or anything to announce. Anything going on since last time. Rod, of course, your Dr. Jekyll and the Werewolf just was available for pre-sale just a few days ago, and I believe it's already close to selling out.
The limited edition is, yes. The regular edition will be available for, you know, for years to come, but yes, the limited edition is very close to being sold out over at Mondo Macabro. If you're still looking for one, you might want to take a chance and see if they've still got a few by the time you hear this show.
And as you're one of the hardest working men in podcasting and commentary recording, have you got anything else that you want to tell us about at the moment?
No, I'm back in the saddle recording new podcasts to fill out the rest of this year. Got one recorded just last night, actually. Should be out soon after this show is. With my buddy Randy Fox and I getting back to our 70s science fiction fetish, I guess would probably be the best term for it. We discussed Phase 4, which is a film that, if you want to talk about an obscure science fiction film from the 70s, that one is pretty much there. Mm. It's definitely in cult status these days, and I think it's kind of begun to gain some status with the cult film aficionados over the last decade or so. But yeah, we're talking about Phase 4 on the next episode of The Bloody Pit.
Excellent. Yeah, that is a good film. And of course, by coincidence, there are a few Randy Foxes that live in the back alleys around my house.
Yeah, years ago, I had to fight down the urge to explain to people that is his actual name, regardless of how, you know, descriptive a term that might seem to be. That is, yes, his real name. I can attest to that. I've seen his driver's license. It's his real name.
It does depend where you live as to whether that is funny or not. Anyway, so let's crack straight on then. We are talking, of course, in this episode about the film Samoa, Queen of the Jungle. also known as Samoa Regina de la Jungla, which is a pretty direct translation. In French, it's Samoa Fille Sauvage, which I think means savage child.
Yeah.
Or savage daughter, maybe. My French is even worse than my Italian. Now, I was looking at where this film got released, and barely anywhere, it seems.
Really?
Yeah, so Italy and France, because it's an Italian-French co-production, which then also meant it got a release in Belgium. I found a Turkish poster online, and according to the IMDb, it did get released in Turkey 4 years later. So this is 1968, when all of these films were bouncing around. But for a few years later in Turkey. But as far as I can tell, it had no UK release. The IMDb says that in America it's known as Samoa Queen of the Jungle, but I've been able to find no evidence that it was ever released in America at the time. And there are DVDs out there in Italian. So it's sort of floating around, and that's how I managed to see. It's quite a decent copy, actually, and I think it is also on YouTube. So it has had home video releases, but... yeah, but at the time, this did not, despite the fact that it's got an American star, it did not get picked up for distribution in America.
Well, that's just it. Something that we've noticed is that most of the films, and I think all four of the films that we're covering in this little mini season here on the show, were produced within about the same 12 to 15 month period, around 1968. And, oddly enough, some of them, I mean, we realize, you know, the information about Luana, the one we covered last time, it didn't get released in the States until 1974. And so I think that there may have been this rush to make Jungle Girl pictures for a brief period of time for some reason. And then a realization that perhaps the market is glutted. And although we've already produced this thing, maybe we hold off and we don't necessarily try to farm it out to distributors around the world currently and bide our time, see if we can sell it down the road. And maybe this is just one that didn't get sold in certain territories. I don't know.
Yeah, no. I can't find a single review of the film, contemporary review in English. I did also, though it's not on the IMDb, but it was reviewed in a Portuguese publication, so it may have been released in Portugal at the time. But yeah, quite limited, which is interesting, like I said, considering the fact that it had an American star, although an American star who was mainly working in Italy for a few years. But also, of course, a very early film in the career of Edwige Fenech, who has come up on the podcast before, of course, when we very much enjoyed her adventures. You may remember the film quite well, and the title of which, what was it called? It's just gone out of my head.
Oh, wait a minute. Which Edward Finch film did we cover?
Oh yes, Ubalda.
Oh, of course, the sex comedy. Yes, any chance to see her is golden, I will admit. But yeah, yes. That one, like so many Italian comedies, did slip my mind.
Yeah, Ubalda, All Naked and Warm. She did a whole bunch of comedies, far more comedies than she did horror films. But of course, to us English-speaking fans, it's primarily the giallo that we think of her. But
yeah.
So she was in Samoa. This was her second film, according to the IMDb, but it's kind of her first starring role. And it would be a couple of years later that she started to do the films that we actually know her more for, like Top Sensation and stuff like that. But yeah, so obviously we've talked about her before as well, because not only I think that has been the only film, isn't it?
That's the only one that we've talked about with her in it so far.
The only one we've done. Yeah, no, never mind, I'm getting my female stars confused. Yeah, so we talked about her in the Ubalda episode, but I mean, of her other early films, like, she did another one just after this with the same director. So the film is directed by Guido Malatesta, and he obviously really liked Edwige Fenech, because he cast her in his next film after this one, Il Figlio di Aquila Nera, which I think is Child of the Black Eagle, which is a sort of historical drama. So she's done a couple of interesting films early on. Are you familiar with any of those early ones?
No, I will say that I'm very curious about the film you just named, because I guess I'm a sucker for those kinds of stories in the first place. So I'm actively attempting to seek that one out, see if I can finally see it.
Yeah, and it's a sequel as well, I believe. So there's a couple of films in that story. She did a couple of German sex comedies as well, which she did a Frau Wirtlin film and Sexy Susan, that kind of stuff early in her career as well.
Yes.
It was a couple of years until she did Five Dolls for an August Moon, of course, which has sort of cemented her reputation for giallo fans.
Well, in Case of the Bloody Iris and Your Vice is a Locked Room. And,
Strange Vice and Mrs. Ward, all that stuff.
Oh, wow, yeah. That's one that's well worth anyone's time. Those are, she was for a period of time there kind of the queen of the giallo.
Yeah, but I would like to watch more of her comedies from that period. You know, she did one that Dick Randall was involved with, called the English title is Let It All Hang Out or L'Uomo del Pennello d'Oro, where she basically plays the girlfriend of an artist and spends the whole film naked while people paint her. I mean, I'm sure it's very funny. I'm quite intrigued by that one.
I gotta say, some of the comedy films that she was in, the titles alone, the English titles, yeah. When Women Were Virgins, The Inconsolable Widow Thanks All Those Who Consoled Her.
Yeah. The Hot Nights of Don Giovanni.
Mm-hmm.
They just showed there's, you know, obviously we've talked about the comedies before, but there's a whole sort of huge area of film that is effectively just ignored in terms of when we talk about Italian cult cinema. There's so much of it that sort of gets left to one side. And a lot of she did so many movies that most of us, myself included, have never seen. Beautiful Antonia, first a nun, then a demon.
I would be more than willing to watch Dr. Jekyll Likes Them Hot, even though I assume it will stink.
Yeah, and then of course once she was a real leading lady and she played the sort of school teacher films, and there's a few films where she plays a police officer, and I mean there's one called, the English title is A Police Woman on the Porno Squad.
That's a title that draws me in immediately.
There's a lot to her career that is still relatively unexplored, certainly by me, and I would imagine by a lot of English speaking cult film fans. And a lot of that's just because I guess they're just largely unavailable. I mean, this film, Samoa, you have to, it's not immediately available with English friendly subtitles. You have to sort of go around the houses a little bit to get an English version, and that's probably the same with many of her other films. But we like Edwidge Fenech, and the fact that she's sort of still working, she's still a producer, isn't she? And
yes,
occasionally still pops up on television. She's got a credit just for this year on Italian television. So, yeah, very cool. But before we get to the rest of the cast, let's talk a little bit about Guido Malatesta, because he's quite an interesting director as well. He's got quite a long run of films through the 50s and 60s.
And I have to admit, I did not know who this fellow was until just a couple of days ago, looking at his resume.
Yeah. I mean, he did our next film, Tarzana, as well. So he obviously enjoyed this particular genre, or at least he just reused the same sets again, which is probably more likely.
Probably.
But he did a whole bunch of... I hate saying that, a whole bunch. He did several Peplum films.
Mm-hmm.
He was involved with these either as a writer or as a director. He did some Machiste films, a couple of Colossus films. Did one called Colossus of the Stone Age, which I think I've got a UK press book for somewhere in my collection, but I haven't actually seen it. But yeah, so he's not a director you're particularly familiar with then.
Well, that's just it. I have not paid attention to his name before, but it turns out I've seen at least two or three of his peplums. I think I've seen Colossus and the Headhunters. I know I've seen Machiste versus the Monster. Goliath versus the Giants. It's possible. And I know I've got a copy of Fury of the Barbarians that's in my to-watch stack, but I don't think I've seen it yet.
He also did one that sounds right up your street, Samson versus the Pirates.
And I think I may have seen that one too. I can't be sure.
Yeah. Yeah, he sounds like he seems like he did really well for about 15 years and then died. So I mean, he'd worked his way up in the industry. So by the time he was directing, he was already fairly old, I guess. It's hard to tell. I've not been able to find much information about him, but he was only 51 when he died. So actually, he's not that old. But in those days, that was quite old, I suppose, when everyone started smoking when they were 12.
Yeah, it looks like he had gotten the majority of his earlier credits in the 1950s are for being a writer of different screenplays. So yeah.
Yeah, he wrote Head of a Tyrant, which is another, it's like an early historical drama rather than a peplum, which I've got a poster for in my collection, but I haven't seen. So I'm sort of, his name is sort of buried there in the back of my mind, even though this might be the first one of his movies that I actually watched. But yeah, somebody that's worth looking into a bit more. He did a couple of Euro spy films as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just another director and writer working in whatever Filoni were making the money at the time.
Well, he, as a writer, he had a hand in one of my favorite little unsung films, an early film by Umberto Lenzi from 1963 called The Invincible Masked Rider, which I think is a much better film than people would probably give it credit for. But then again, I don't know that many people who have ever actually seen it. It takes place in 17th century Spain, and it's kind of like a combination of Zorro and Robin Hood. Really, really fun. The star is Pierre Brice, the guy who was best known at the time for playing Winnetou in those German Western films. He had a hand in writing that for Umberto Lenzi, and I just absolutely love that film, and I wish... It's that genre, whatever, you know, ruffled collar or rapier and ruffled collar, whatever you want to call that particular type of film. I just wish there were more of them that were being even just considered for release in the high definition age, because I think there's a lot of joy in those films. There's some just really good movies, and I'm hoping that one day some enterprising young video company will take it upon themselves to put together some kind of series of box sets along the lines of the current gothic trend that we're getting from Severin, and take advantage of how many of those really interesting kind of Three Musketeers style films are out there for people to see.
Well, this film, Il Figlio di Aquilinera, the Child of the Black Eagle, that he made after Samoa, was one of the writers on that was Umberto Lenzi, so they kind of flipped it around there.
Oh, okay, good. I'm very curious to see that one, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so speaking of writers, let's also talk about the writer of Samoa, because this is a guy who is worth talking about, Gianfranco Clerici.
You're sure of that awful name? Okay.
No, it's terrible, isn't it? I sound like the guys in... Inglourious Bastards. Margheriti. Gianfranco Clerici. This was a writer who needs no introduction, but we'll introduce him anyway. He's written loads of great stuff. Delirium, Phantom of Death, House of Clocks. So like the 80s stuff he was still writing. But you get a bit
Cannibal
lower.
Holocaust.
Exactly. New York Ripper, Cannibal Holocaust, House on the Edge of the Park.
Wow.
Like, this is a guy who...
And The Last Match. That just came out on Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah.
My goodness.
Murder Rock. I think you're a fan of that one, aren't you?
I am a fan of Murder Rock. It's true.
Yeah. He wrote loads of great films. This guy just kept churning them out. Five Women for the Killer. Don't Torture a Duckling. Bloodstained Butterfly.
Special Cop in Action.
Yeah. But then he wrote a few films for Guido Malatesta, including Samoa, Child of the Black Eagle, Tarzan of the Wild Woman, High Crime, There's another name that he's
that's a great credits. Film. I love that movie.
Yeah. So, yeah, quite interesting guy.
And... he wrote The Antichrist, the 1974 film.
Yeah, which just came out on Blu-ray.
Yep.
Recently over here, so I just bought that. Yeah, so I'm assuming at some point, although the name was not that familiar to me, he must be on an interview on a Blu-ray somewhere.
Is he still with us?
Well, according to the IMDb, he's still with us.
Wow. I would hope that someone somewhere has interviewed this fellow. My goodness.
He's the kind of guy that would have been interviewed by somebody on one of these many releases, so it's worth keeping an eye out for. I'm sure he's got some interesting stories to tell about this different stuff that he wrote. I mean, just the fact that he did three of the most controversial films, New York Ripper, House on the Edge of the Park, and Cannibal Holocaust, that's quite a triple bill to have on your CV. Plus, he did one of the Black Emmanuel films, and yeah, loads of stuff.
He did Devil Fish, but we can't they can't all be hits, guys. Come on.
Yep. So yeah, so some interesting credits behind the film, I think, and of course the music as well for this movie, quite good, I think. I'm not familiar with the composer, but I remember last episode's. We didn't talk about the music at all. That was really good too. But anyway, this one was composed by Angelo Francesco Lavagnino.
Yeah.
Another composer with tons and tons of credits. Over 200 credits, including things like Queens of Evil and just tons. Yeah, lots of stuff.
Several Eurospy films, and that's where I knew him. That's how I realized that I have quite a bit of his music in my my digital music collection because of his connection to the Eurospy genre. Some really good stuff there, yeah.
And composed the music for Gungala.
Oh, yeah.
And also Tarzana.
Yeah, yeah, and the 1969 Zorro film.
More to the point, Wild Wild Planet, and
exactly the electronic music for those four films, those four science fiction films.
So this is probably a name that we should know a bit more. I mean, we know Riz Ortolani and these kind of people, but maybe because the Angelo Francesco Lavagnino is a bit more of a mouthful, we don't tend to sort of talk about him and his stuff in the same breath as some of those others. But yeah, pretty much almost every cult film you can think of, it's probably him. Mission Bloody Mary, which is one of the Agent 077 films that I really love. Yeah, loads of stuff. So yeah, lots. So this is so Samoa. I would say of the three we've now watched so far, Samoa feels like the most professionally made.
I'm going to have to agree. I think you're right.
I mean, maybe that's partly because the quality of the copy was better as well.
That may be so, but I would also argue that there just seems to be more story, more intrigue in this one than in the average Jungle Girl film from the period.
Yeah, and this is another film where basically you didn't even need the Jungle Girl in it.
Or she didn't need to necessarily be, you know, the daughter of a white man, you know. Living with
and
the
she's
tribe.
Not. She's not a jungle girl. She's certainly not the. She's certainly not the queen of the jungle. But we'll get to that. Let's just mention a couple of other notable names in the cast, really quick. Roger Brown, of course,
the star.
Our man, Roger Brown. We're going to talk about him in our next season because he is, of course, the one and only Argo Man.
Yes. Yes, he is.
The superhero who loses his powers when he has sex.
My goodness.
Looking forward to that.
We're mining some weird areas at times, aren't we?
But he also... So he's an American star, but he basically his career was primarily in Italy.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's one of those American actors who realized that he was probably going to have a lot better luck if he came to Europe and made his bones, became an actor on screen, and then, you know, he probably had visions of doing what Clint Eastwood did, which is, I can't get into movies in the States,
yeah,
so what I'll do is I'll go to Europe, I'll make some Westerns, see if these pan out, and then parlay that into a film career in Hollywood again. And of course, for Roger Brown, that didn't quite work out.
No, but what he did do, which is interesting, is he stayed in Italy and worked in dubbing. And he did a lot of dubbing. He got involved in that because obviously there was a lot of that going on in Rome in the 60s. There's a really good interview with Roger Brown that our friend Derek Cook did a few years ago on the Dorado Films podcast. He did it. There's a brilliant episode where he talks to Roger Brown and they talk about his career and they talk about obviously Argo Man, but they talk about the dubbing and stuff as well. I'll put a link to that in the show notes because that's definitely worth listening to.
Oh, that's really, that's an excellent interview. Derek did a great job with that.
Really, really interesting. But yeah, he just did a whole load of the... I keep saying it again. I nearly said whole bunch again. Somebody shoot me if I say that again. He did lots of great films like Barabbas.
Well, I mean, he was a, you know, a background, uncredited, you know, kind of gladiator character in that,
Yeah. And then he's in some of the Peplum films, and then the Eurospy films, and then, of course, Argo Man, Samoa, and then, of course, let's not forget that he is the senator who's really into snuff porn in Emmanuel in America.
Yes, that's true.
Which is quite something. And then he's in The War of the Robots. Didn't we do that? Did we do The War of the Robots?
Man, I can't remember which one of those got awful.
We did one of those, didn't we?
That we did, yes.
I'm not sure. He was in one of those terrible films.
Oh, God, those movies are so... Oh, I can find almost nothing to praise.
Yeah, let's not. But he did. So he had an interesting career. Then he took a break for about 20 years and then started... Or 30 years. And then according to the IMDb, he's been working up until just a few years ago, so...
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's like he's doing just small roles in like in different things. It's kind of neat.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to talking about Argo Man a lot. It's going to be really fun. A couple of other names. I don't know if there's anyone in the credits you particularly wanted to mention. I wanted to mention the other two leading ladies, basically. But is there anyone you wanted to? Oh, actually, there's three. I tell a lie. Just while we're sticking with the men. So in the film, they go out into the jungle, obviously, and they have a guide. And they have a guide whose name is Akana. And, of course, because he is black, he is the first person to get killed, sadly.
Yeah, you're right.
That's where we were at in those days. But I just wanted to mention him because we've seen him before. He is the guide in... I should say we've seen him before. I don't think he was in Wild Wild Planet. But he is also... He turns up in the Snow Devils. So he's Wild Wild Planet adjacent. So and then he's had a few other good credits from the Orient with Fury, which is obviously a film I'm always talking about. He's in one of the couple of Sandokans, but he's also in a Fellini film, so he had a decent career. But anyway, so I wanted to mention him, but then I just wanted to mention the two leading ladies. Other two leading ladies, sorry. We've mentioned one of them. There's two more. There's Ivy Holzer, who plays Nancy. She had, again, a sort of quite minor career.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know anything about her. This is one of those things where I've been searching around, trying to find information about this film. There's very little.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything on Ivy Holzer other than her IMDb page, to be honest.
Like, that name would suggest that she wasn't Italian.
Or that it is that she's well enough hidden behind the pseudonym to avoid all kinds of hunts.
Yeah. So I've got nothing on her at all, except that she does have several credits.
Yeah, she was in a number of films, some of which I've seen, and I don't know a thing about her. She was in she had an uncredited role in Messalina, which is the most recent thing that I saw that she was in. But she was also in Wonders of Aladdin, which is yet another thing in my on deck circle.
Of course. Yeah. So don't know much about her, but she's pretty good in this film, I think. But I also wanted to mention Femi Benussi, who is beautiful. I'll just come out and say it. I don't think that's a controversial statement. She really is. But we've seen her before because she was in Luigi Cozzi's The Killer Must Kill Again.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She plays the sort of blonde hitchhike. Well, she's not a hitchhiker. She's broken down, and then she ends up conning herself into the car to get a lift with the killer, if I remember rightly. So that's her. And she, as another person who's been in loads... Oh, we also saw her in the 1001 Nights film that we watched.
Oh, okay.
The one that Antonio Margheriti's film. She did a lot of Decameron films, actually, around that time. But she's also in things like Hatchet for the Honeymoon, and she's in Tarzana, so we're going to see her again. Bloody Pit of Horror, which is, I'm sure, a film that people will know. So, but in this film, she doesn't actually have that much to do.
No, she doesn't.
And according to the story... We'll get to that, because I'm not entirely sure who she is within the logic of the film. Not entirely sure it makes sense what she's doing there. But anyway, so that's the cast, and we've mentioned most of the people behind it. I think, was there anyone else that you wanted to pick up on that I've missed, or?
No, we've covered the contributors that I was most impressed or curious about. So yeah.
Oh, one other name in the credits, who she's credited as choir director, was Nora Orlandi, who would also go on to be a composer, and she did the score for Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward. So
okay.
there's another connection. But anyway, okay. So I was looking, because I couldn't find any English language reviews. And there are so few reviews themselves online. The IMDb has 3 reviews by fans, or people who've watched it. The Letterboxd has 9, which is a bit more, but there's very little out there. I managed to find one blog that had talked about the film. So considering considering this is Edwige Fenech, and you'd think more people would be interested. The amount of weird films that do get picked up on and written about online, maybe because it hasn't had a lovely Blu-ray release from Vinegar Syndrome, it just hasn't been picked up on. So I was struggling to find a plot summary, and I finally found one on a blog called Rubber Axe, and I'll put the link in the notes as well. And this was only published a couple of years ago, so it's relatively recent viewing. Somebody was celebrating Edwige Fenech's birthday, so they thought they'd go back and watch this. So I'll do my best to go through the plot summary. What's interesting with this one is there are some significant differences, I would say, from the last two films.
Yes.
The last two were kind of carbon copies of each other, plot-wise. At least this one is a little bit different. So we begin in the middle of a brawl in a bar.
Pre-credit bar fight.
Yeah. And that reminded me of one of the agents, I think it's one of the Agent 077 films, where there's just a fight going on in a bar for no reason, except that he's on holiday and he's just having a good time. And it made me wonder what this was, whether it's some kind of fight club, because like, do they just go there to have a big fight? Because he's just enjoying himself, punching people in the face, getting punched in the face. This is our man, Roger Brown, or Clint Lohman. And he's there for a meeting, but for some reason, while he's waiting, he just gets involved in this massive fight.
I think maybe he just gets bored and needs to punch things. Yeah. I'm not sure.
And it's supposed to establish him as the hero, I suppose.
Or at least, I guess, a man of action.
Yeah. So, Roger Brown, Clint Lohman, he is... I was thinking about this. You know, his name is Clint, and by the end of the film, he really is a bit of a Clint. He's
okay, wait just a minute. what do you mean by that, sir?
He is not a good guy. Like, he's the hero movie.
That's true, yeah.
But my goodness me, he deserves to be caught by a cannibal from a later Italian cannibal movie in the jungle.
And yet his character survives the film and goes off with Edward Finnick and diamonds. So
yeah, he is a real a-hole. Like, he's the hero, but then about in the last act, it's almost like they had one script and then they lost it, so they got a different script for the final act where his character is completely different. It's very odd.
It's as if we we're being led down the garden path about his character, yeah. And then you find out no, he's just as much of a scumbag as yeah. all these other characters.
So we follow. So he's in a meeting with Mr. Wong. I'm not sure where we are, but I think we're either in Malaysia or Hong Kong.
I think it's one of those two places. I can't.
And
remember.
Mr. Wong is putting together a team to go to Borneo to look for some waterfall beyond which there is evidence apparently that there are diamonds.
Yes.
So he's putting a team together. Now I assumed they would be finding these diamonds in a cave, like in a
mine.
You
would think, yes.
So I assumed that that's what these guys are doing. He's putting together a team to go and dig for diamonds. But apparently not. There are easier ways to find diamonds, it turns out. So yes, he's putting this team together, which is all men, and then naturally one beautiful blonde who is coming along. That's Ivy Holzer's character. She is the secretary of the geologist who mm-hmm. is coming on the trip.
This segment of the film I generally refer to as untrustworthy team assemble.
Yeah.
Because these guys are already cutting eyes at each other, and
yeah.
none of these people are actually going to abide by anything that doesn't keep them alive and possibly really, really wealthy. So.
There is one particular guy who's very shifty. And there are so many characters, I forget what his name is, which one he was. He might have been Pierre.
Was he Moreau? I can't remember anymore.
Maybe, yeah.
Alan is the one, or Alan.
Alan is the nice guy.
He's the one that actually turns out to not really be a jerk. Yeah. Not that it does him any good whatsoever.
No. Yes. Yeah, so in this film, yeah, if you're a nice guy, forget it. They head off to look for diamonds deep in the Borneo jungle. And we get to see quite a lot of stock footage. I mean, this film, this is something that, you know, Ed Wood would have been impressed with the use of stock footage in this film. They patch in a lot of stock footage so that you get the impression they really have gone on location.
I know there are moments in the film, there are sequences where it really does feel that feel effective. Yeah. Even when some of it's a little bit ridiculous, like the point at which we stop to watch two snakes fight each other. It's like,
what? Oh man. Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. So there's a sequence where, and we again, it feels like we're, this footage feels like they must have bought it from a Mondo movie shop.
I would bet. Like, yeah.
It feels like leftover Mondo footage. But there is two snakes fighting, and then the one snake swallows the other snake whole.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about that, and then I was imagining, what if that snake then got swallowed by a bigger snake? And like, it's like when you know how you get people stuff, I don't know, like a pigeon into a duck, and then a duck into a chicken,
a turducken into a turkey, various fowl,
yeah,
into other fowl,
turkey or, into a goose. It's like,
it's like, huh? So how much? I mean, that's a lot of protein, yeah. I guess. I don't know.
But the one snake swallowing another snake until eventually, just the tail of the snake is sticking out of his mouth. It's like, oh, that's really weird to watch.
it's unnecessary, it's padding, and it's clear that they spent money on that footage and we're going to yeah. see it.
And there's quite a lot of footage of crocodiles or alligators. Yes. I'm not sure which. Crocodiles, I guess.
Quite a bit. Some of them repeated.
Yes. And there are tigers as well. Which they there's one guy, the bad guy gets attacked by a tiger at one point, and they sort of cut between real footage of the tiger and then close-ups of him being sort of poked in the face by a tiger puppet, which is quite fun. But I did wonder whether, because there's also footage of a chimp, and the chimp and the tiger, so with the stock footage, it's different film stock.
Yeah.
So you can tell straight away, I think, like, it's possibly even 16 and blown up to 35 because it's a bit more grainy, or it's sort of second generation footage. compared to the footage of the actual film. Whereas some of the footage of the tiger and the chimpanzee is the same film stock as the rest of the film. So I wondered whether they had actually got some, you know, like a local circus or something, to get the animals into the set. So I'm not entirely sure, but there's definitely a lot of stock footage. Later on, we get a lot of stock footage of the headhunters, the headhunter tribe, who are called the Kayaks, I think they call them. So all of that stuff is all stock footage as well. It's quite interesting. And even later on in the film, there's a bit where they're all at a party, like a ceremony, and there are these topless tribal girls.
Oh, and that's all Mondo footage.
And that's all stock footage from the waist up. But then they just cut to shots of them from the waist down to show our actors are sitting on the ground watching these girls. And like the difference in quality of the image is so obvious. It's kind of funny how they cut between these and they expect you to not believe that it isn't really happening. But anyway, yeah, so lots of stock footage. But that's fine. It does the job. So they're basically heading into the jungle. They've got to get to these waterfalls to get beyond the falls to find the diamonds. And they stop and set up camp. And this looks exactly like the same set as where they camp in the previous two films we've watched.
Yes. And they didn't even, they barely like did anything to make the set look different at all.
I expected Gungala to just swing past in the background at one point.
Well, this is what kills me is this one set, which is, you know, next to quote unquote the river. They visit this same place that's supposed to be different places at least three times. Yeah. And each time it's just like, I think their one attempt to give it a different look is they shifted where the camera was placed so that you had a slightly different angle, but it's just like, it's the same place, guys. It's the same location or same set, I should say.
So they set up camp for the night, and this is after, I think we've had the guy has been attacked by a tiger. We've seen the snake get eaten by another snake.
Yeah.
And Clint Lohman and what's her name now? I've already forgotten her name. Nancy has got eyes for Clint because he's the strong, heroic, square-jawed type.
And the scumbag bad guys already attempted to rape her and.
Well, this is what happens in the tent that night. So we see the silhouette. She's getting undressed in the tent, and he's standing outside with his tongue hanging out, looking at her silhouette.
Yes.
And so then he just goes in and attacks her, and she struggles and screams for help. So Clint Lohman comes running along, and he beats this guy up. But then eventually, and then he just says, okay, everything's fine now. Like...
No, it's not.
Why does he want to keep this guy in the group? He's clearly just going to be trouble. But he just sends him off to go on watch, even though he's tried to rape the one woman in the team and then beating him up. So that's all a bit odd, because then Clint comes back into the tent to check she's okay. And his checking that she's okay basically means they start snogging. So,
which, you know, you would expect. I mean, he has to brush a spider off of her lap, but, you know, other than
that. Oh, yes, that's true, yes. As if he wasn't already a hero enough, he has to kill a big spider on her leg.
I've kept the rapist at bay, and yes. I've saved you from a supposedly deadly jungle spider. So, you know, perhaps it would be a good idea for the two of us to have intercourse.
Yeah. Now, of course, this is all very well, but this is only because... he hasn't met Samoa yet.
Ah, yes. Samoa shows up 33 minutes into the film. Clocked it, yeah.
So the next day, they head up the river, and I think they start getting attacked.
Yeah.
So they're trying to avoid the Kayak tribe who live around here. They've got to get past them to get to the waterfall. And so they get to the waterfall, and then... this is when they come under attack, and this is basically where the film turns into a western.
This is kind of a fun action sequence, and I gotta be honest, there were clearly dozens of these headhunters. It's just wave after wave of them.
Or just the same five guys.
Well, see, I don't know. I mean, that's a strong possibility, don't get me wrong.
Getting up and running back again.
But it's so effectively filmed and edited enough so that it really does, it's really an exciting sequence, I have to give it credit.
Yeah, because we've got our adventurers behind rocks firing their rifles whilst being shot at with spears and blow darts. And the guide, Arcana, he bites the dust, sadly. But I felt this sequence was very, just could have been taken out of any Western. It was exactly like it was.
Yeah, it was certainly staged in the same way.
Staged the same. And so this is where suddenly Samoa turns up. But unlike our previous two films, she just immediately starts speaking Italian.
she speaks to them and I love that, you know, Clint is his first reaction is, how do you speak our language? And she's like, well, let's worry about that later when we're not about to die. So she leads them into the caves there to escape the headhunters.
So she takes them into the caves where you're expecting to see, you know, glittering walls or something like that. But no diamonds in the caves yet. So she takes them through this cave complex to get to the top of the waterfall. And they do an interesting job of cutting between actual spectacular waterfall footage and standing by some waterfall halfway up a mountain, I don't know where, somewhere in the middle of Italy, presumably.
Somewhere probably not too far from Rome, yes.
Yeah. So she takes them to her village at the top of the waterfall. And so this is where the film takes an interesting turn from what you would expect it from a Jungle Girl film. Because she's not the survivor of a plane crash who's become one with the animals. She doesn't actually have any interaction with animals at all, not even the chimp.
Nope.
She doesn't telepathically talk to panthers, nothing.
She's just a slightly paler version of the other native women.
Yeah. So it turns out that she lives in this village, and the village is, I was trying to work out where, because we're supposed to be Borneo, but the extras and the actors in this sequence looked more like a sort of combination of people they'd found from India and possibly East Asia. There's a sort of mixture going on.
Well, there may have been some kind of student exchange program with this village somewhere. I'm not sure what was going on.
But so she introduces them to the chief and they take them to a hut and basically make them very welcome. So it turns out that Samoa, her father, years ago, came looking for something. We don't know what it is yet, but he came there and he fell in love with the place because it's like, you know,
paradise. Paradise. I mean,
yeah. And he fell in love with a local girl. He stayed, had a daughter. That's Samoa. What then happened to him? We don't really know. He's not there anymore. but there is an interesting, you know, there's a skull on a spike just over there. Is that? No, I don't know. I don't know. We don't know what happened to her.
Yeah, we don't know what happened to her father.
But she is there. And I suppose it sort of makes sense because particularly with the sort of makeup and everything that she has, you could sort of buy the fact that Samoa is the daughter of a white man and a local woman. Perhaps.
No, I mean, it's. I'm willing to give the film that. It's not.
Yeah. But she has a friend called Yasmin, played by Femi Benussi, who just looks Italian. It's like, well, hang on, are you her sister? Who was your dad? Was it another? We don't know.
Yeah.
So, but she starts learning Italian. She falls in love with Alain. There's just a little side plot there where they're falling in love with each other. So he decides he's going to stay. And then presumably father the next Samoa, I guess.
I assume.
But so they get in with the local tribe, but Yasmin makes a fatal error and she takes Alan on a little tour. So, because what happens is, so these guys, they believe that there are diamonds somewhere nearby. And I mean, Rod, you're a clever guy. You're a man of the world. How would you go looking for, if you had to go and look for diamonds, where would you look?
Okay. Starting off with the caveat that I am far from being a geologist. I don't think I've even been in a geology class since I was 20. But
I don't think any of these guys were geologists, not even the actual geologist.
I would say that my understanding is that diamonds, being the hardest substance on the planet Earth, generally you look for these things in cave-like structures. This is how they are. They are something that I've always read about and described, heard described as having to be mined. Yeah. So when these guys spend an inordinate amount of time doing what looks to me like panning for gold in the streams nearby the village, there's a part of me that wonders, well, is that possible? I mean, and for someone who knows as little as I do about geological facts, maybe it is. But I am unsure, and I'm willing to, like I said, I'm willing to give the film credit for doing this. There's a part of me that wonders if, in an earlier version of the story, what they were there was to attempt to discover was actually gold, which would make sense.
It didn't need to be diamonds at all. They could have said you're looking for gold, and everyone would have been fine, and because. But they're panning for diamonds, and they don't find any. And all I could say watching them was like, "Well, yeah."
Well, it's like, I mean, like I say, it's possible. We could, someone out there under the sound of our voices, if it is plausible or likely or just regular operating procedure to hunt for diamonds downstream from where they might be in a mountainside. I'm willing to believe that, but. Yeah. This is the only film that I've run into where this is the procedure being used to determine whether or not there are diamonds nearby.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose if you're being generous, you could say that they were looking for the diamond seam. So if they had any bits of diamond show up in a river, they could follow that to wherever it was coming out of the ground. And I don't know.
But that's the logic behind panning for gold.
It seems pretty unlikely.
But
so
gold is an incredibly soft metal.
Yeah.
Whereas, once again, I'd like to stress, diamonds are not soft.
Yeah, they don't float along the river and then just settle in the riverbed. So they are all very unsuccessfully panning for diamonds. And they've been there a few days. They're getting a bit cheesed off because they're not finding any. There's already been at least one point along the way where the bad guy has talked some of the other guys into just leaving. Giving up, but
geologist fooled them by showing them something that he claimed was a diamond.
Diamond is a piece of glass. Yeah. But anyway, so they can't find any. But then Yasmin, because she's so in love with Alan, she takes him for a little tour of local
sacred spot.
Yeah, which includes a cave where they just have basically a bucket full of diamonds.
the cave of the stones of life.
Because these have been washed up by the river, and they represent life, and it's part of their religion. So Alan just, mentions this to Clint.
He doesn't mention it. He blurts it out excitedly.
Yeah, they all go and have a look. But but then they're told very seriously that this is all very sacred and they shouldn't be there. And fine. And you think, well, that's okay. Because by this point, of course, Clint is falling in love with Samoa.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's definitely falling in lust. We'll come back to the love
now,
part of this later.
He's completely forgotten about Nancy by this point.
Well,
Nancy just gives Samoa typical sort of jealous, dirty looks all the time.
Dagger eyes at every venture.
Their relationship is, they're just... And Samoa's like, I don't think she likes me.
Well.
Duh. So suddenly, this is where it all gets, like, we've got this massive group of people and most of them don't have that much to do. Nancy, her role as the romantic lead in the film is now gone because Samoa has turned up. So Nancy doesn't have much to do anymore apart from be annoyed, and she spends more time with the professor and they keep looking at these samples and they're not finding the diamonds. So the bad guys decide they're going to steal the diamonds whilst the village put on a topless dance parade for them.
Yes.
I think that's what it was called.
Who knows? I did notice that all of the nudity in the film is from stock footage and would therefore be easily editable out of the film for television viewing.
So. Yeah. So they are all at a party. They're going to be at this party, so the bad guys are going to steal the diamonds and then make a run for it. So they're putting this plan together, and then Clint walks in all heroic, and you think he's going to say, no, we can't do this. They're sacred to these people, and we should respect these people's beliefs and traditions. And they tell him what they're going to do, and he's like, yeah, I was going to do the same thing.
Yep, that's my entire plan.
Oh, no.
Why do you think I've been having sex with Samoa? I want her on our side. We've got to have her lead us out of this place.
I forgot to mention, yes. So there's an interesting moment a bit earlier here where, yeah, he seals the deal with Samoa. And there's some very sort of symbolic filmmaking going on where she's holding a flower in her hand. And then she sort of, they close up on it as she drops it on the floor. And then there's this footage of the two of them, and there's some slight nudity from Edwidge Fennec, but they've superimposed flowers over the top to sort of cover it all up. So obviously, you know, it's a very heavy-handed symbolism about her being deflowered by Clint.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because I have to admit,
it's pretty funny.
It's honestly, I kind of want to give the film credit for a little bit of wit there. Because they didn't have to do that. You know, there's no requirement that they be, you know, quote unquote artistic in their display of this particular part of the film to get across the idea that, yes, you know, as you said, Clint has sealed the deal. But I love that they did go out of their way to do this, and that is one of the many reasons that I like this film and feel it is a little bit of a cut above the standard Jungle Girl movies that were being produced at the time. There is some effort being put forth here.
It could only be even more on the nose if he'd started popping back a few cherries during this.
Oh, Adrian, that is not the phrase I expected you to say. Oh, my goodness. Okay, yes.
Yeah, well. He just walks out of the tent afterwards with a bowl of cherries, like, hey, what's up?
Just chewing on them and spitting out the stones,
So, you know, we think that this is all very beautiful, because Alan has already decided he's going to stay behind. He doesn't want to be involved. He wants to stay with Yasmin. And we sort of assume that Samoa and Clint are an item now. But then it turns out, you know, Clint just says to these guys, yeah, why do you think I've been getting Samoa on our side? It's so that we can steal all the diamonds. So during the party, you know, Alan is sitting there with Yasmin, not at all suspicious as to why all of his friends have disappeared. But they are all stealing the diamonds in the cave. But then, of course, they get caught. And they run away, and they get chased by the tribe across the field. And then there's a sort of standoff where they're all pointing guns at each other.
And Alan is on, or Elaine, depending on which version you're watching. Yeah. He's he's with his girlfriend there on the side of the natives, and Clint and the other guys make him realize that, you know, if you stay here, they're going to blame you because you're part of this group, and they're probably going to kill you. So you really kind of need to come with us. And none of this works out well.
But of course, Samoa is saying, you've got to give the diamonds back. And he's saying, well, I'm not going to give the diamonds back. And then the bad guy, who I wish I could remember his name, I just keep calling him the bad guy.
It's Moreau, isn't it?
Which was it, Moreau? Sorry, yeah. He shoots one of the tribe's people. And then Samoa is like, well, I'm definitely not coming with you now, you asshole. So he points a gun at her and says, yes, you are. I mean, what kind of a basis of a relationship is this?
It's not a good one. It's not going to work out well. Yeah.
He's used her. He's stolen stuff from her that was sacred to her tribe. Now he's forcing her by gunpoint to come with him. So she's like, oh, okay. So off they go. But then they get pursued by the stock footage headhunters again.
Yes.
As they're going down the river, which leads to some quite exciting scenes and another shootout. The professor, the geologist, Dr. Schwartz, and his beautiful assistant Nancy. So Dr. Schwartz gets hit by.
I thought his last name was Dawson. Which maybe we watched a different translation.
Dawson. Sorry, yeah, not Schwartz. Dawson, you're right. Professor Dawson. He gets hit by a spear, I think. He's injured. Or is he shot?
I can't remember. Moreau shoots. I can't remember. But yeah.
This is where it all gets a bit confusing. It all happens quite quickly. Moreau steals the diamonds and runs off. And I think he shoots Dawson. Clint and Samoa go after Moreau. This is after they've shot loads of the headhunters, who then all run away again. And because Nancy is so afraid, she just basically steals the boat and runs off with Professor Dawson, and they leave. And that's the end of Nancy. Whatever romance she had with Clint is long gone.
Well, I mean, you would think so, obviously, yes. But, yeah, so they're gone, and that's the last that we see of them, actually.
And so... So Moreau is running off with the diamonds and they're having a shootout with Clint.
Oh yeah, he's stolen the big bag of diamonds.
Yeah,
running through the jungle, trying to escape on his own with all of the diamonds. Clint is pursuing him, and we get to one of my favorite jungle cliches.
Oh yeah,
although it is also a swamp cliche. And it is something that the joke goes, hey, didn't we all think we're going to have to deal with this crap a lot more as adults? He hits a patch of, say it with me, folks, quicksand.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, quicksand is basically, from my understanding, and obviously I read a lot into this because I assumed I was going to fall in some at some point. You can just swim in it like water.
Yep. You just try to lay along the top of the surface and stretch your way towards something to grab the hold of and pull yourself out. Yeah.
You don't just get sucked under it.
Well, but, unless you're holding God knows how many pounds of diamonds. Yes.
Yeah. So he just gets slowly sinks into the quicksand, but takes the diamonds with him, and he says, "I don't want to die." And Clint's just like, "Oh well."
Yeah, it's a shame.
So he's dead, and the diamonds are gone, and Samoa has seemingly forgiven Clint because they then find a load more diamonds in his pocket, and then she's like, "Oh, good," and then they snog, and that's the end.
And they're happily on a stolen native boat.
Oh, yeah, they find a boat.
On their way away from all this danger.
Yeah, away from her, the only home she's ever known.
With a fistful of diamonds.
With diamonds stolen from her people to go and live where? What are they going to do with those? You know,
well, see, here's where you have to ask the question, Adrian. What kind of basis for a relationship is this?
Yeah, I know. He forced her at gunpoint. Trashed her people's belief system, stole from them.
Exactly.
They killed a bunch of them, and now he's going to take her like to go and live in a trailer park somewhere. I don't know what they're going to do.
I don't know. Maybe with those diamonds, they'll be living in a very nice villa someplace. But
yeah.
Will she ever be able to really trust him?
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you right now, the answer is no.
No. So there you go. That's the film. And so why? What exactly is she queen of? She's certainly queen of the jungle,
my friend, and don't you forget it.
I mean, we basically barely see her in the jungle at all, apart from at the end when they're just chasing the guy with the diamonds. At no point, like I said, does she commune with animals. She doesn't swing on vines. She doesn't fashion any kind of special cure for something that somebody needs out of plants because she's got great... Like, nothing. She lives in a village that's above the jungle. So, and she's not even, like, the daughter of the king of the tribe.
No, she's just another part of the tribe, yeah.
So she's a very misleading title, is what I'll say. It's almost like they were trying to pass this off as a Jungle Girl film.
When it isn't.
When it isn't.
It's a jungle adventure film. That is all this
is. Yeah. This is like Treasure of Sierra Madre with a bit of Tarzana thrown in.
Well, yeah, if they had stuck, you know, Ingrid Bergman into it and claimed that she had some real plot, you know, some real plot just significance of some sort.
Made her wear a bikini for a very revealing bikini, you should say, for the whole film, but speak fluent
whatever language they're speaking. Yes. I think the version I saw was in Spanish with English subtitles. I can't remember.
And how did she know those? Maybe she'd been following them, I suppose, and listening to them. Because she knew straight away that they spoke Italian.
Well, she had been watching them, you know, get attacked by the headhunters. And so I think she'd been watching them for some little time.
But it's not even like the headhunters thought she was a god and ran away because they were scared of her or anything. Like, none of that stuff.
No, so, it's just that the caves that she leads them through are some place they will
they're
not
scared
go.
Of the caves. Anyway, I mean, I'm not complaining. It's a fun film.
I don't know,
it
sounds like we're complaining.
It's not really a Jungle Girl film. And the hero is a scumbag.
Yep, he is. Clint Lohman is the last name tells you a little bit, I think.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, he really is. And also, why is she called Samoa? I mean, they're in Borneo. They're nowhere.
Is the name given to her by her parents. So, I mean, you that's know, true. You'd have to ask them, and they're both dead.
Or are they? We just don't know. And her dad came looking for diamonds and then stayed. For one reason or another,
maybe he was forced to stay.
Yeah, or maybe they ate him. We'll just never know. It's an interesting film. But yeah, it's not what I was expecting. I was expecting to see her swinging through the trees. But also, unlike the other two, where sort of finding the jungle girl was part of the plot, this one is, she's very incidental. She's barely necessary to the plot at all.
And yet, at the same time, and maybe it's just because there's such a sameness about the previous two and about Jungle Girl films in general, this one being as different as it is kind of makes me happy. I'm kind of glad that it's so different and that it has despicable characters that I can really sink my teeth into disliking, you know.
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly fun.
Yes.
But yeah, it's just sort of interesting in its being so different, but this is trying to pass itself off as something it basically isn't. It's kind of like a jungle adventure film with a little bit of Euro spy thrown in, I felt, particularly at the beginning, in the bar and everything.
Well, one last thing I want to talk about, and that involves Roger Brown and his fist fighting technique. And since we're going to talk about Argo Man eventually down the road, I wanted to go ahead and get this out in the open. Roger Brown's fighting technique in film is absolutely hysterical to me. Because I've described it this way. Punch, pause. Punch, pause. And it's in every film I've ever seen him in, where it's the most unnatural form of throwing a punch I have ever seen in my life. Where there is no follow-through. It's not as if he's actually punching something in reality. It's as if he's punching and then expecting everybody else to freeze. Stop. You know, punch, pause, punch, pause. And as the movie opened and I saw that, I just immediately rolled my eyes and went, oh yeah, I forgot about that, about Roger Brown. This is so weird.
Oh, yeah, it's funny.
It's like, you know, if you were really in a fight, that pause is going to get you slapped in the back of the head with a chair. So
yeah, but it's like he's pausing for the edit.
Yeah, I know. It's really quite strange.
Yeah, yeah, yes. I'm looking forward to Argo Man. One last bit of trivia that I've just found whilst we were talking: the stock footage actually comes from an Italian documentary from 1955 called Continente Perduto, or Lost Continent, which is actually shot in Borneo. So there is actually some accuracy in terms of at least they picked a film that was from Borneo. So all of that stock footage is from that film, apparently. So there you go.
Well, yet another point in the film's favour.
Yeah. So, yeah, interesting. Which I think possibly that film is now lost, or at least no longer available, so at least we get to see bits of it in here, I suppose. Yeah, so there we go. That's Samoa, a very interesting and odd little film. Definitely worth seeing, as I, you know, I think I pretty much say with all of these.
Yes.
Apart from War of the Robots, I definitely didn't say that time. Anyway, so we will be back for our final Jungle Girl film soon, which is going to be Tarzana, the Wild Woman. I think that's right. Thank you to those of you who've been getting in touch with us and talking to us on Instagram and Twitter and also on Facebook. We do like hearing from you. Please also email if you want to make any comments, or if you've now watched any of these films with us. I'd really like to hear what you thought of them. I know some people have been contacting me asking me for links and stuff like that. So yeah, if you've now watched it, give us your thoughts. Give us a review. That would be interesting to hear. Rod, any final thoughts before we finish?
I am really enjoying going through these Jungle Girl movies, as marginal as they are, and as let's put it this way, I think to a large degree we truck in this show in bringing to light or talking about less well thought of or less traveled roads of the Italian exploitation films, and these types of things, I think they do deserve more attention. But I think shining a spotlight on such a very small genre as the Jungle Girl thing does bring to light that you're really kind of panning for diamonds. Get it? Panning for diamonds? In a field, full of dirt, grass, and the occasional jungle spider. It's fun. These are, I would be curious to see if anyone is kind of following us down this path, because it is an odd path to take. I don't know that the bookshelves are not littered with books on this particular subgenre at all. And so there's a certain curiosity on my part to kind of generate some interest in this, even if the films are not well thought of, and I completely understand why. They are of interest. There are things in them worth talking about and worth being entertained by. And I do hope to hear from some people about these films if they've ever viewed any of them. Just out of curiosity to see where other people's points of view kind of poke through the soil and spring into the light, because it's strange. Yes. It's a strange subgenre.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thank you. Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks everybody for listening. Please do get in touch, like I said, Twitter, Instagram, email. All the links are in the show notes. Or just search for us, Wild Wild Podcast. You'll find us. I think that's probably all I've got to say. This journey through the jungle has left me quite exhausted. So we'll leave it there. Looking forward to coming back for more with another Guido Malatesta masterpiece of Tarzana. Thank you everybody for listening. We will be back soon. Bye for now.
Bye everyone.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.